Support for the morning show comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, a unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe, Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. Support also comes from Carthage College, announcing the first in a series of concerts and recitals that comprise the Brahms Project, a survey of the great piano music of Johannes Brahms. The first concert tomorrow night, 7:30 in Siebert Chapel, featuring Carthage's faculty trio. And we welcome you to the Friday Morning Show. I'm Gregory Berg, with two interviews today for you for Black History Month. Once again, we return to the compelling figure of our 16th president, Abraham Lincoln, this time in conjunction with another very important American, Frederick Douglass, and a fascinating book which draws interesting comparisons between these two important men. The book is called Giants, The Parallel Lives of Frederick Douglass and Abraham Lincoln. The book is by John Stauffer, Chair of the History of American Civilization and Professor of English at Harvard University. And perhaps you know him from a previous book called The Black Hearts of Men, Radical Abolitionists and the Transformation of Race, as well as Meteor of War, The John Brown Story. He has written a very compelling book indeed here, and it is published by 12 Books, and I'm so excited to have this opportunity to speak for a few minutes with John Stauffer. John Stauffer, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thanks a lot, Greg. It's great to be on the air with you.
And I should think that you would regard as quite propitious the timing of this book, in that America, of course, has just elected its first African-American president. And what an appropriate time for us to be looking back at as important a figure as Frederick Douglass.
I know. In fact, I started writing the book around the time that Obama launched his political campaign, and it was published on Election Day. And during the entire writing, I felt like I understood what I call the Obama phenomenon very well, because both Frederick Douglass and Abraham Lincoln were great influences and inspirations for Obama.
Yes.
So, yeah, the timing could not have been better.
I hope you won't take offense at this question, but it seems that this book, which I love, by the way, is one in a fairly substantial stream of kind of similar books. I'm not accusing you of being a copycat, but I'm really struck by how many books have crossed my path over the last year or two, which have in effect done the same kind of thing. That have looked specifically at, for instance, the friendship of FDR and Winston Churchill, or compared the careers of Grant and Sherman, or that kind of thing. I think it's a fascinating vehicle by which to learn something new about someone where maybe we feel like we know all there is to know. I wonder what it felt like to write this book and any maybe particular challenges that are part of trying to compare two separate lives which intersect only intermittently?
Yeah, that's a great question. I'd say that the rise of a dual or collective biographies have been a fact over the last 5 years or so, and I think there are a number of advantages of dual or collective biographies in general. It gives us multiple voices from different vantage points, for one. So a biography that's, say, just on Lincoln, we understand Lincoln's world just from Lincoln's perspective, and I think one of the drawbacks of doing that, particularly with such a mythic or iconic figure like Lincoln, is that I think too many writers romanticize him in the sense that for them, Lincoln can do no wrong. And Douglass and Lincoln became friends, and it was a very close friendship. It was primarily a friendship based on utilitarian needs, but they genuinely liked and enjoyed each other in crossing the racial divide. And yet Frederick Douglass never agreed with Lincoln politically. They stood apart, because Douglass was always a radical, Lincoln was a moderate, and Douglass was not afraid to criticize him. And So I highlight what I think were Lincoln's flaws, just as every human has flaws, and in doing so, I think at least I gained newfound respect for him because of his capacity to rise and overcome the mistakes that he made. And so I think one of the reasons for one of the advantages of a dual biography, it gives us different perspectives, different vantage points. The result is a fuller, rounder understanding of each person, much as you could use the analogy of photography, much as taking multiple photographs of a subject from different vantage points and perspectives can offer a more complex portrait. And because of the really rich parallel aspect of Lincoln and Douglas's lives and the fact that they became friends and really enjoyed each other and liked each other, I think was one of the reasons I chose that approach. And the second thing I would probably say is that the concept of friendship is another concept that writers have latched on to in the last 10 years in understanding how people evolve and change. Friendship has been a major theme or concept in Western culture for the going back all the way to classical Greece or Aristotle, Plato, Cicero. Friendship was as important as democracy or liberty in thinking about society, because for thinkers, friendship was seen as a symbol of a virtuous society. A virtuous society is one in which friendship flourished. And the concept of friendship was crucially important through the 19th century. So in the antebellum period, when Douglas and Lincoln were alive, when they defined someone as a friend, that meant something. That had symbolic significance. In the 20th century, friendship has largely been used as a kind of concept of a commodity. You think of Dale Carnegie's How to Win Friends and Influence People. That kind of summarizes the way in which friendship is used, or politicians saying, you know, I'm going to invite my 1,000 closest friends to my party or my birthday party. And writers, I think, are in the recent years, in the past 5 years, understand how important friendship, the concept of friendship, is in shaping lives and in shaping culture as well.
Well, true friendships, and especially once upon a time when friendships were seen as, in a sense, in almost more sacred fashion.
That's exactly right. In fact, from one of the reasons why the concept of friendship was so important is that it had a sacred dimension for Aristotle, Plato, and Cicero. Friendship was defined as though it was two souls, two bodies united into one soul. And that understanding of a sacred friendship, what some people now refer to as soulmate, which is, I think, a 20th century expression, has persisted into the 19th century, into the 20th century. And there was certainly a sacred dimension about Douglas and Lincoln's friendship. They said as much after their first meeting, and Douglas had three meetings with Lincoln, and that doesn't include all of the times that they talked about each other.
You talk of them as leading strikingly parallel lives, and one of the ways in which they were parallel human beings was something you talk about in the preface, that they were perhaps the two preeminent self-made men in our country's history. Summarize for us why that is such an important parallel to draw between the two of them. I mean, in what way that shaped the connection that ultimately emerged between them.
Right. The reason that I argue they're the two preeminent self-made men in American history is that most people know that Lincoln grew up with nothing. He began in the dregs of society. He had less than a year of formal education. He rose up to become, in my view, the greatest American president. Frederick Douglass was born as a slave, was prohibited from reading and writing, had no formal education, and rose up to become the most famous black man in the Western world before he was 40. Frederick Douglass was better known in his day than Lincoln. Lincoln did not enter the national political or the national scene. He wasn't a nationally known figure until 1860. And so that rise is truly extraordinary. It was also an era in which it was not uncommon for men to be able to rise up. In fact, the very term self-made men was coined when they were still young men, when Lincoln was in his 20s, Douglas was still a teenager. And the very concept of self-made men was important because it reflected not only someone who was able to rise up, but the definition of self-made men also reflected someone who sought to change society, reform society, at the same time in which they made themselves. Crucially, I think that self-making, and particularly as Douglas and Lincoln defined it, understood a new concept of the self. That is, a self that was continually evolving, continually changing. And that is true. If you look at Douglas and Lincoln in 1835 versus 1840 versus 1845 and so on, in each of those 5 years, they were different men than they were the previous 5 years.
And then one of the most important elements to that, then, is how this is directly in contradiction to the concept of racism.
Exactly.
You said, ultimately, Douglas and Lincoln understood that self-making was antithetical to racism. This was
right.
Because the idea of whiteness as a sign of superiority and justification for oppressing blacks depended on believing that the self was fixed and unchanging. Lincoln and Douglas, of course, are symbols of just the opposite, exactly the opposite of that.
That's right. And in that sense, too, they were at the forefront of a major shift in the very concept of the self or in the concept of character. You know, at the time and in their day, they were seen as equivalents of almost con men because people liked the notion of character or self that was fixed, that was unchanging. It was Americans at the time had difficulty grappling with the fact that someone would start at one station and become someone entirely different and then continue to evolve. And so the fact that Douglas could meet Lincoln the first time in the White House, that Lincoln would call him up even though Douglas didn't have an appointment, and they would feel immensely comfortable with each other right off the bat, that even though Lincoln was not a radical abolitionist, that Lincoln, as a politician, could not have been radical. He never would have been elected, was a moderate. And Douglas would, after the first meeting, say of Lincoln that he was one of the only white men, one of the few white men that I've ever met who treated me as a man, not as a black man. And Frederick Douglass was used to hanging around radical whites who thought of themselves as devoting their lives to the cause of blacks, and yet Lincoln, because of his continual self-fashioning, treated and perceived Douglas as another human rather than as a fixed racial type.
We're talking with John Stauffer about his book Giants, The Parallel Lives of Frederick Douglass and Abraham Lincoln. We should mention that besides the big picture in terms of how these two both figure so prominently and crucially in our country's history and around this particular issue of racial equality, that there are interesting ways in which their lives, on in a sense a more mundane level, run parallel to each other. And you draw out a lot of these in really fascinating fashion. For instance, you tell stories from each of their lives of how a fist fight proved to be something of a personal turning point for each of them, for Frederick Douglass and for Abraham Lincoln. Just talk for a moment about that.
Right. As young men, as you said, they both defined a fist fight as a crucial turning point in their young lives. For Frederick Douglass, he was still a slave on the eastern shore of Maryland. He had been sent back to the eastern shore where he was born from Baltimore after his owner died in the estate. He was sent back to have a new master. And he was, when he moved back to the eastern shore, he had already learned how to read and write. He was seen as insolent, and his new master, Thomas Auld, rented him out for a year to a man named Edward Covey, who was known in the area as a famous slave breaker. So Covey would take what was called insolent him, and every week, mercilessly, Douglas was whipped. He said that the welts on his back from the whip were as thicker than his finger, and before they had even healed, that he was whipped again. And he endured that for 6 months and finally stood up to Kobe and said, even if I die in this attempt, I'm going to stand up to this man. And did so. They had a two-hour epic fight. Douglas defeated Kobe and had enough discipline not to kill or seriously hurt Kobe, because had he done so, he would have been either killed or sent into the deep south, in which his potential for getting free would have been impossible. And so Douglas says that Kobe had been whipped by a boy of 16. Kobe never touched Douglas again, suddenly had this newfound respect, and never revealed to anyone the fight because he didn't want to undermine his identity or his identity as a slave breaker, which would have cost him money. And after the fight, Douglas said, from that moment forward, I defined myself as a free man in form, even if I would remain a slave, in fact, for a while. And from that point forward, he seemed to escape virtually every day, every waking hour. And so it really was a crucial turning point. Douglas wrote three autobiographies, and in all three, that fight becomes a climactic moment in his life. For Abraham Lincoln, it was similar. He had just turned 21. Lincoln had defined the first 21 years. He had defined himself as a slave for his first 21 years because, particularly for poor white boys, they had to turn over all their earnings to their father. That was the law, and until that you were 21. And Douglas himself understood that. He would play with white boys on the streets of Baltimore and say, you know, you'll be a free man at 21. I'm a slave for life. And they would say, yeah, gee, isn't that too bad? So Lincoln had just reached manhood for the first time, could earn his own money, moves to New Salem. He's the new kid in town. He's huge, 6'4", and at the time when the average height of men is 5'7". And the local leader in New Salem, which was a brutal backwoods community, was a man named Jack Armstrong. And Armstrong was known for luring strangers into poker games, beating them up, stealing their money, and sending them on their way. And Armstrong felt threatened by this new kid in town and wanted to fight him in a rough and tumble, which was a very brutal kind of fight. In fact, it was not uncommon in a rough and tumble to have a ear bitten off or a nose bitten off. The greatest prize in a rough and tumble for some fighters was to liberate an opponent's eyeball and to keep it as a trophy. And there were men in New Salem who lacked eyes because of fights. And so Lincoln did not refuse to fight Armstrong in a rough and tumble and agreed to regulated wrestling bout, which was less violent fight. And they, too, had a kind of important epic fight. People came from all around to bet on it. Evidently, Jack Armstrong fouled Lincoln, broke the rules. Lincoln called foul. They called the fight a draw. No one lost money. And Lincoln immediately thereafter became a leader in New Salem. Jack Armstrong befriended him, and within a year, Lincoln was elected captain of his company in the Black Hawk War, and within the next few months, started his career as a politician in the state legislature. Hmm. And so he pointed to that fight as an important turning point in his life. And what's ironic about both of these fights is that they occurred at the very moment in which both men were aspiring to be intellectuals. They already loved words and language and literacy and understood that the easiest way to rise up in society was by using words as weapons rather than fists as weapons.
Right. And it's so intriguing, especially when we follow the rise of Frederick Douglass, but really this is true of Abraham Lincoln, too, of how these two who had virtually no organized education at all rise to become such amazing orators and wordsmiths. Frederick Douglass, partly through something called the American Anti-Slavery Society, which helped give him, in a sense, opportunities to speak about slavery as someone who knew about it firsthand.
Right.
You tell us that, incredibly, Frederick Douglass eventually became so accomplished that he had allies telling him he needed to pepper his speech with more plantation talk So people would believe that once upon a time, this formidable, elegant, beautifully well-spoken man was once a slave. I mean, it became almost unbelievable after a while.
I know. It really was, and that's well said. Both Douglas and Lincoln, they both learned to hone their brilliance in language on the same six books, and they virtually memorized them. One was the Bible, which I think is one of the great works of literature in Western culture. One was Shakespeare, Lord Byron, Robert Burns' poetry, Aesop's Fables, which was a collection of oral tales from slaves in ancient Greece, and the Columbian Orator. And the Columbian Orator was a collection of speeches designed for young boys to become orators. And Douglas got his hands on a copy when he was in Baltimore, and that was his most important book, more than any of the others. It was his first real book that he read. And in the introduction of that book, it was by Caleb Bingham, who was an educator. He taught the young boys how to speak, how to lose their accent. He emphasized that in a democracy, one needed to speak as a democratic gentleman, which meant one needed to lose a pronounced dialect. And so Douglas, even as a slave, practiced his public speaking, tried to lose this pronounced slave dialect. And so when he started lecturing for the American Anti-Slavery Society, which was the organization that William Lloyd Garrison controlled, he was already good, and he was a full-time lecturer, went all through the country, and he was so eloquent. He was also blessed with very good looks. Everyone who saw him speak said that he was immensely handsome or beautiful. One admirer said he was majestic in his wrath. And he was a brilliant performer. Now, so he not only that what he said, but how he said it was just dazzlingly good. And people could not believe that someone like him could have ever been a slave. And that led to his first best-selling autobiography. Because by 1844, in early 1845, increasingly journalists and people in audiences said that he was a fraud, he was a fake. There's no way that someone like him could have ever been a slave. He had to have been educated. So he decided to write a tell-all narrative, naming his slave masters, naming exactly where he had been born. The overseers. Edward Covey, because of that book, becomes one of the great villains of world literature and history. And the book is an overnight sensation.
A portion of my conversation with John Stauffer, the author of this fascinating book called Giants, The Parallel Lives of Frederick Douglass and Abraham Lincoln, published by 12 Books. And in this portion of WGTD's morning show, I'm going to be speaking with Joe Drape, New York Times reporter and best-selling author, talking about his book Black Maestro, The Epic Life of an American Legend. It tells the inspiring and also troubling, sad story of a black jockey by the name of Jimmy Wingfield, the last in a long line of talented and successful black jockeys who rose in prominence in the sport and then in quite cold-hearted fashion were turned out of it. The book is published by William Morrow. This story is so odd when we compare it, for instance, to the story of someone like Jackie Robinson or Althea Gibson. I mean, we are so often talking about the first black to break into the ranks of a given sport. This is exactly the opposite. When we talk about Jimmy Wingfield, we are talking about the last black. It's such an odd thing. Just help us understand that for a moment, about how the story of an inspiring black athlete can be such a sort of a story in reverse from those which we're normally concerned with.
Well, what happened is, you know, people don't realize that 15 of the first 28 Kentucky Derbies were won by black riders. And it makes a lot of sense, which I found in my research, is, you know, slaves took care of the horses in central Kentucky and in Virginia. They were the trainers, the grooms, the riders. Horses were treasures. There is a whole handed down legacy of slaves, of black men, teaching the younger generation how you handle a horse. So, you know, Civil War comes, they're emancipated. Yes, they go right into the Derby. They are the most famous athletes in America at the time, next to boxers. But there's a backlash to Reconstruction, and Jim Crow laws start coming down. You can't ride on the same bus, the same train, separate water fountains. And going hand-in-hand with that, there's an influx in New York of Irish immigrants coming into the States. And there's an organized crime element of Irish gangsters up here. And they figure out, hey, these little street urchins, we can teach to box, cycle, and ride horses. We can buy them from their parents for $25 a year, and we can send them out to all these tracks and take a cut of their earnings. And that's exactly what happened. So, you know, you had Jim Crow from the macro, and then inside the track, you had these white boys, and they were tough guys, and they were just trying to survive too. But they're riding side by side with these African-American jockeys and punching them, running them into the rails. I mean, Jimmy almost died in Chicago in 1902. Because a guy ran him into the rail because they wanted the black jockeys off the circuit. So, you know, I came across this story. I covered horse racing for the Times. I see two paragraphs on Jimmy Wingfield. He's the last black jockey to win the Derby, 1901 and 1902, one of four ever to do it back-to-back. But, you know, what really caught my eye, Greg, is not only what kicked him out of America, but then this remarkable life he embarks on there. I mean, you know, some people call him a real-life Forrest Gump. He lived through two world wars and was like a principal participant in the Bolshevik Revolution. He has this extraordinary trail drive that makes Lonesome Dove look like a walk in the park, of saving 262 of the finest horses in America, or in all the world, in Europe, driving them from Odessa, 1,100 miles over 3 months to Warsaw, getting shot at by the Bolsheviks, starving along the way. You know, again, Hitler, World War II, and he ends up back here in Depression-era America. So, you know, in total, it's very sad what happened to him. It would be like LeBron James right now being told, hey, you can't play in the NBA anymore. You got to go make a living somewhere else. But that's exactly what happened to Jimmy.
And it's and of course it didn't just happen to him, but it happened to all of his compatriots, his colleagues, his fellow black jockeys. It's interesting too, as you help us understand the historic context and that period when there were many great black jockeys. It's interesting what they were able to enjoy. You said the racetrack offered dignity to a black man who had a touch with horses, but it was a dignity that could be challenged at any time and taken away in an instant. I mean, at a glance, it might appear that black jockeys were being treated equally. In fact, that was never quite the case, but at least it was a place where they really had some opportunities that would have been more elusive in other arenas.
Yeah, and there's an old slave saying that was passed down by these jockeys, is the only two places men are equal are on the turf and below it. Basically saying at the track there is this uneasy respect, and then when you were dead. And, you know, Jimmy grew up at a time where 300 people, many of them his neighbors, were getting hung all around him. If you'd looked at a white guy cross or said something that offended his family, that you could be beaten or worse, hung, shot. And, you know, I outline a couple of those things. So.
And you also, if I may jump in, there's that quote that just kind of makes us ill. You quote some kind of publication from down south saying, well, the favorite Christmas tree decoration this year seems to be black men hanging from nooses.
Right, right.
I mean, it's a chilling, chilling thought.
You know, and it was a chilling time, and I will give Jimmy, I think that whole period braced him and prepped him for what was to come. I mean, I think the things that he learned there was, A, he had an incredible gift with horses, and he worked hard on it. In those days, you didn't just show up and get on a horse. 7 years old, he was taken in, given the oral tradition by older grooms and trainers. He did didn't really get on his first horse till he was 14. He didn't ride his first race until he was 18. It was old school. You worked your way up from top to bottom. So, you know, he knew he had a gift. He knew he had to work to keep with that gift. And he also knew that he was in a precarious place in society that at any moment, as you mentioned, it could be taken away from you.
I'm reminded of one of these earlier figures who you tell us about, someone named Isaac Murphy. And you say he was among jockeys. He was the biggest black star of them all, and in fact, the biggest star in all of American sports at his peak, which is really something. You go on to say a little later, after kind of outlining his career, he was a star, even if he was one that shone in a segregated and subservient constellation.
Yeah, Isaac Murphy was, you know, horse racing was our national sport at that time in the 1870s and 1880s. And, you know, it makes sense. Baseball was just in its infancy. Boxers were pretty big, but Isaac Murphy had it all. He was a well-spoken African-American. He even had a white valet, something Jimmy emulated when he got to Russia. He was making more money than any other athlete in there. But sure enough, you know, and it goes back to this taken away. He wins all these derbies, all these American futurities, the Belmont. He's still one of the most decorated riders ever. But near the end of his career, and he was a young man at the end of his career, he was accused of being a drunk, being a drug user, and basically was racially tinged insults that happened. And, you know, you'd read the language in the newspapers of the day, and, you know, they all but are out using words that we wouldn't even say in public.
One of the things that is kind of touching as we follow Jimmy's development as a jockey is that we realize that this is the kind of trade which one did not learn by going to school someplace. You really learned it by hanging around the track, by talking to other jockeys, by, in a sense, really needing the generosity and interest of people who are already in the business. And apparently, Jimmy had a real gift for getting people to open up to him and to share this life with him. And, of course, the other thing is he was observing the every move of the great jockeys on how they did what they did and why.
And, Greg, that's really a great point to pick up. This was a guy who found the right benefactors from age 7 on. He'd sit on that fence, those limestone fences, and watch those boys ride the horses around. And then he finally bugged them enough, and they'd bring them into the barn. They'd teach them how to rub the horse. They'd start telling them what means what, you know, what touch means what. He hooks up with a couple of old white trainers, you know, small-time guys. One's daddy was the mayor of Lexington, dedicated horseman. They start putting him through the paces where he can only walk a horse for a while. Then they give him a stopwatch and say, okay, click off a quarter of a mile. They make him walk every inch of the track every day because it's in his job to know where every rock, pebble, hole is. He then goes and hooks up in Chicago with Big Ed Corrigan, who's one of my favorite figures out of this whole thing, who was the owner and builder of Hawthorne Racetrack, who was a gangster and a gambler. And basically, he had hired Isaac Murphy. He and Isaac Murphy had won a bunch of races together, so he had an affinity for African Americans. And, you know, this guy gets in incredible brawls, but at the same time has a soft spot for Jimmy, and he gives him a start. When he gets to Russia, and you know, you've just pointed out the educational arc. There's no school books involved in this. Jimmy had a seventh grade education. He was 5 feet, 100 pounds. When he finally gets run out of America after this remarkable run at the Derbies, he goes over to Russia by himself with a Polish to English dictionary because he's going to Warsaw, and he meets this man, Michael Lazarev, and Jack Keane, who was an old horseman from Kentucky, and Keeneland Racetracks named after him, had been over there, and he'd gotten run out of Russia, allegedly for cheating. So he hooks those two guys up. And Michael Lazarev is not only a dedicated horseman, he's as rich as the Vanderbilts and the Rockefellers and the Rothschilds at the time. He He's an Armenian who controls the Baku oil fields. He has a sterling operation, and he really wanted to breed race horses that could run in England and France and, you know, take his place among the kings and captains of industry. And, you know, this guy imparts all his knowledge to Jimmy. I mean, that really, you know, his gift and this knack for, I guess, just soaking up all the knowledge out of people who were smarter than him.
Of course, things change so dramatically for him, and one of the things that changes the prospects for black writers is the creation of something called the Anti-Colored Union, and the way in which the Jockey Club of New York City began organizing itself more like a private club with all kinds of regulations, which, among other things, seem to begin running blacks out of the business. You say that some of those efforts were to try to bring the chaos of horse racing under some control, but how tragic that towards that end it would be carried out in the way that it was, and that measure of control would be extended to exclude these gifted black jockeys.
You know, they had high-minded goals, but unfortunately, they were low-minded folks. And these were some of the richest industrialists in the world at the point. The Jockey Club, yes, they wanted to say, okay, let's everybody get under one group, have one set of rules, one set of infractions, one set of punishments, because there were tracks all over everywhere. There were more than 300 at the time. But the Jockey Club also was formed to keep Jews and Italians out of the ownership ranks, and eventually to keep blacks off the racetrack. And the Anti-Colored Union was fronted by the white jockeys who were up here in New York, but it was really these guys involved in it because New York didn't like the African-American influence. They weren't used to it like they were down south in Kentucky. And the African-Americans were the best riders, and they'd have to come up here and win all their races. And this irked the power structure here. And down south, they wanted to keep riding black riders, and it was just a matter of economics. These fights and skirmishes that would break out in the racetracks was hurting their horses, and they couldn't risk their horse to ride a guy like Jimmy anymore.
Hmm. And, of course, that's one of the most heartbreaking things, too, is that, you know, you have these jockeys who are looking for mounts, looking for trainers who will let them, the jockeys, ride a given horse. And you talk about how, for Jimmy, one of the most heartbreaking things was not only his own difficulty in getting mounts, but he would see some of the greatest black jockeys who had ever been now forced into this situation of indignity, of having to sort of go almost like beggars from trainer to trainer, desperate for one to be willing to take the risk to allow a black jockey to ride their horse. I mean, these black jockeys who had tasted such great success and triumph just years before.
It was devastating for him up here in New York to see Willie Sims, who not only had won all these Belmonts, won Derbies, he's in the Hall of Fame now, but he was the first American rider to go to England and rode for the Queen over there and killed him over there. They hated him over there because he won everything. And, you know, 2 years after that, after being at the top of the world, he's out here in Belmont Park doing the same thing Jimmy is. You know, please let me ride. I'll ride a couple of your nags this morning if you give me a mount in the afternoon. And this was a guy Jimmy got to learn from because they were at Latonia Park together. Jimmy was just an apprentice trainer groom at that point. Sims was the biggest jockey. He'd follow Sims around, and he'd watch him when he was working out horses. And, you know, he knew that Jimmy had foresight, too, because before he left, he knew he had to leave the country 5 years before he left because he saw what was going on with Sims. And he thought, you know, if the greatest rider in the world can't get a ride, what am I going to do?
Hmm. Well, of course, he returns to Kentucky, where black jockeys still enjoyed fair access to the race and there. To the racing world, and there he manages to win the Kentucky Derby twice in a row, and the first time riding a horse called His Eminence, and achieving this great, great success. At one point in the book, you talk about how this figure of Jimmy Wingfield had going for him an interesting combination of dignity and street smarts.
Yeah, I mean, Jimmy was no saint. He knew enough. He could mix. He's one of those people who can mix with the czars and the princes, which he did frequently, and who could play a good dice game in the back room of a black boarding house. And he did know where his place was in any given room. In fact, I got cross-eyed from a night in Chicago, rolling dice, drinking moonshine. In Chicago, where he was probably most comfortable, he hung down on the south side in the gambling halls and brothels of the Tenderloin District. And he knew the score. He knew who he could trust and who he couldn't trust. And he also had this great personal elan and style, these nice double-breasted suits, these sweater vests were his trademark. And he could waltz into a room full of rich aristocracy, white folks, and not look out of place, too.
Hmm. And that, of course, served him well in this business as well. He realizes, of course, that America is an increasingly dangerous place and really an increasingly impossible place for him to pursue this work. So he heads abroad, and of course, that's where some of the most extraordinary adventures happen for Wingfield. Tell our listeners really quickly the story of the saving of the horses. I mean, this is something straight out of a movie script.
He's up in Odessa, which is the Saratoga of the empire at this point. The revolution's in full bore. He considers himself a white Russian, meaning aristocracy. He's up there with some rich guys. They, like everybody, think, okay, we're waited out here. We're beat back to Bolsheviks, and then we'll go back and return to our high life. April 4th, 1919 comes along. Cannons boom. The French abandon. All of a sudden, Odessa's under siege. There's an old Polish officer named Jurchevich who had a plan, who saw this coming. Just like that, two dozen men round up 262 horses and the women and children and start to drive towards Warsaw. They got to go a long way away, Bucharest, to drop the kids and children and women off. The whole time, they're getting shot at. You know, thoroughbreds are not meant to be ridden 1,100 miles over 3 months. They're meant to run fast 2 minutes every 2 weeks. So they're starving. There's no food to be had. When they go into villages, they're beset upon by people who think they're gypsies. So, you know, this was one of the most remarkable, remarkable things. And, you know, to this day, Greg, that is like one of the greatest moments in Polish history, because when they get to Warsaw, it's now independent Poland. They've been liberated from the Russian Empire. And if you're good with a horse in that part of the world, you're known to have a touch of Wingfield.
That's amazing, isn't it?
Yeah, no, it was the most fun of the research, was trying to piece together this just harrowing journey.
Well, and of course, his life is fascinating even from there, and the success he's able to enjoy in Europe as a jockey, and then how it kind of all comes crashing down, and the tragedy of losing his son, and then rebuilding his life and eventually returning to America, raising horses and establishing success for himself in another way. Tell our listeners the intriguing way in which you open this book. I think you are making such an interesting point here as you tell the story, which you do in the book's introduction, from the 3rd of May, 1961.
He was invited back to the 61 Derby. The week before, Sports Illustrated does a nice long piece set in France where he's living about this guy, this last black rider, this two-time winner.
And it had been 60 years before that he would have won the Derby.
60 years. He's had this interesting life of trail drives, wars, Bolsheviks. So they invite him to a dinner at the Brown Hotel, which is the luxury hotel still there in Louisville, Kentucky. He goes with his 37-year-old daughter, Lillianne, who at the time is married to a white surgeon who's a graduate of Fisk University, who is a liberated liberal woman. They go up to the front door. Another black man, the porter, doorman there, says, "We don't let you people come in." They kind of look at each other. He says, "You know, we're invited guests." "No, no blacks are allowed here. You can't come in the front door." And to me, that moment said everything. It said, here's a guy who's accomplished everything, still not being recognized. But it also said what Jimmy was. Jimmy didn't yell. Jimmy didn't go to the back door. Jimmy stood there and kept sending the guy back in. "Go find the guy from Sports Illustrated. Go find the guy from Sports Illustrated." He basically wore him down and walked in that front door 20 minutes late. But he did it with great style and dignity. Again, the word dignity, I keep coming back with him. And, you know, he faced this room full of white people. Nobody talked to him. He kept a big smile on his face. And he left through the front door. And to me, that kind of, I chose to open it that way because that encapsulated who he was and what he had dealt with.
It's an amazing story, and I suppose it must be especially thrilling for you to tell a story that up until now has been so obscure. I mean, you are really righting a wrong here, in a sense, by helping the American public understand and appreciate this important figure from our sports history.
You know, you hope to shed a little light on it. You know, books are labors of love. Somebody told me they're literate people's lottery. None of us get rich on this. I cover horses, among other things, for the Times. I've been just entranced with the whole sport and the characters involved in it. And you better want to love in your subject, because otherwise it is just work. And when I came across him, you know, it offered an opportunity to just try to learn this tapestry of history, of, you know, European of global history. Try to get the American scene, when it was probably its most racist, to lay it over this beautiful sport. And, you know, I don't mean being to be flip when I say this, but, you know, for 4.5 years in my reporting and in my writing, I got to be a 5-foot black man at the turn of the century, going through this world wide-eyed, and you try to put yourself in, you know, 10 times a day. I said, what could he have possibly thought when he saw this? And it was fun. And if people can take this story, and it really transcends sports and it transcends horses. It's a story about a guy who never quit. It's that simple. And got to see a wonderful world. And, you know, he made some mistakes. We all do. He's, like many celebrities and athletes, he was very flawed. One very good husband, was a better father late in life. But, you know, he had a remarkable life, and people should know about it.
And thankfully now they can, through your wonderful book called Black Maestro, The Epic Life of an American Legend, published by William Morrow, the author Joe Drape. Joe Drape, this is really an exceptionally interesting book, and I'm really glad we could talk about it today on the morning show. I'm glad you wrote the book, and thank you for joining me on the morning show.
It was my pleasure. It was a tremendous conversation. Thank you for having me.
We have a strong lineup of morning shows next week, including several different interviews airing on Monday for President's Day, including a conversation with tribute actor Eric Richardson, who on many occasions has portrayed Abraham Lincoln. On Tuesday, David Maldonado, who is a flamenco composer and guitarist and the next soloist with the Kenosha Symphony Orchestra. On Wednesday, Jonathan Starr, just featured on 60 Minutes, author of It Takes a School, talking about the creation of a school in violence